Welcome to Inside the Castle, the podcast that goes behind castle doors to have real conversations with real people about solving the nation's toughest challenges.
I'm one of your hosts today, Aaron Snyder.
And I'm Angie Fryermuth.
Today we are doing the first part of a three-part miniseries on the 200-year history of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Civil Works Program. And today we're going to be focusing on the origins of the Army Corps of Engineers Civil Works from 1802 to 1824. With us today is Matt Piercy, John Longquist, and Jonah B. Taylor. Thank you all for joining us here today.
Thanks for having us, Aaron.
So before we dive into this first phase of the history of the Corps of Engineers, could you each tell us a little bit about yourself and what brought you to your role and maybe why you're passionate about history?
This is John Longquist. Yeah, I was that kid who always knew he wanted to be a historian. I didn't know quite what being a historian was, though, so it took me a while to figure it out. I was a history major as an undergraduate, then went to Duke University for my graduate work. I've been an Army historian for close to 30 years. I think one of the appeals of this early period is we can see civil works really coming together. We see the nation's needs, which are pretty clear, and then we see politicians and the Corps of Engineers working together to try to see how we can meet those needs. And then also the emerging tools, technology, and science that facilitated that mission over the next 200 years.
Thanks, Matt. You want to go next?
My name is Matt Piercy. I am a historian here in the Office of History, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. I've been a historian with the Army for coming up on 23, 24 years now. I joined in 2001 the St. Paul District and worked as a district historian for 5 years before taking a job out here at headquarters in 06. My dissertation was a history of the Mississippi River Commission, which is a federal agency that oversees flood control and coordination with the Corps of Engineers and now underneath the Corps of Engineers. And so river history is a natural for me. I'm a civil works historian here in the office. Excited to get a chance to talk a little bit about the General Survey Act and the origins of our internal improvements program.
Hi, I'm Jonah B. Taylor. I'm a historian also in Office of History Headquarters, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. I'm kind of the young person in the office. I've only been here coming up on 7 years now. I studied history for my PhD at Georgia Tech in the history of technology, and I had studied a number of other things before that. Have a master's degree in organizational and social psychology, but history was just so exciting because of the stories and understanding how things changed over time. I actually wrote about Corps of Engineers flood control projects, as they were called back then, in the Southeast, kind of in the mid-20th century. So that's what I wrote about for my dissertation. And I thought it was just such an exciting way to see both how the nation changed and how cities grew, and looking at those projects, part of that larger context was what made me most excited.
Well, thank you all for joining us today, and I'm really excited to have you all on our team and helping us tell this great history of the Corps of Engineers. For this episode, let's start from the beginning of civil works. I have heard that the General Survey Act is very important in that. So can you tell us where did the General Survey Act come from and what was the national need it was trying to meet?
Yes, no question that the General Survey Act is a foundational piece of legislation for the modern Corps of Engineers. It underpins our entire civil works program. And coincidentally, it was passed in 1824, so we are celebrating its 200th anniversary this year. A number of factors that drove the introduction and passage of the General Survey Act include, first, that the U.S. was a rapidly growing nation. If you step back and think about our evolution as a country, we started out as 13 colonies clinging to the eastern Atlantic seaboard there. The American Revolution resulted in a Treaty of Paris, which extended those colonies westward to the Mississippi. In 1803, we get the Louisiana Purchase, which pushes this country well into the Mississippi alluvial valley. That's important because that river would prove to be the most practical way for moving agricultural goods from one of the most productive agricultural regions in the world down the Mississippi River system to New Orleans and eventually to market. So first, the U.S. was a rapidly growing nation. The War of 1812 is another one of those sort of latent factors that contributed to the development of the General Survey Act in 1824. That war provided pretty good evidence of the need for better roads, stronger coastal fortifications. Both would require scarce engineering talent that was only available overseas, perhaps from the French, or from West Point, founded in 1802. By 1820, these Army engineers were already proving their worth. Perhaps a precipitating factor for the General Survey Act is the sinking of the steamer Tennessee in February of 1823. There had been a couple of earlier efforts to pass a General Survey Act or something of its type previous 2 years and had failed. But the sinking of this private steamer on the Mississippi River near Natchez was a pivotal event. The steamer was moving upriver in the winter. It was snowing. It was full steam ahead, and it struck a snag. So a snag would be a tree typically that had become dislodged from the bank, entered the river, floats for a time, eventually gets waterlogged and partially sinks. Often the root system would be embedded in the bottom of the river and the trunk itself either rising just above the water level or just under, which was, of course, more dangerous. And that seems to have been the case on that February evening. The steamer barreled into this snag. It ripped a 6-foot hole in the hull. The ship rapidly filled with water. There were 180 people on board. The best swimmers jumped in and swam for the shore. Quite a few others were able to get into a raft, an emergency raft, to make it to shore. But 60 in the end died, many of them women and children coming from all over the country. About $80,000 in losses, which is a big number, and one you should think about when we talk about early funding for these Civil War's internal programs on a national level. The sinking was national news, appeared in newspapers throughout the country, and became a powerful emotional catalyst for government action on internal improvements.
That's really interesting. It does seem like, you know, maybe you can prove me wrong through this series, but a lot of actions come in response to disasters. So obviously you have the disaster here, the sinking, which was the national news story. But I was kind of curious, why was it that the Army engineers were the logical choice for the nation's response to address this problem?
That's a great question, Aaron. Firstly, until 1835, West Point was the only academic institution in the United States training professional engineers. Given its very competitive admission requirements, it also tended to pull in some of the most talented young men in the country. And so these two factors, the fact that it was the only engineer school functioning in the United States and that it tended to have very competitive admission requirements, meant that for most of the 19th century, the Army was producing best engineers in the country, bar none. And then these engineers would go out with the Army and develop practical experiences that were applicable in the private sector.
So how did politics shape the General Survey Act?
It's a very interesting question, Angela, and one that we recently put some time and effort into learning more about. The General Survey Act is, as I suggested, sort of a foundational piece of legislation for us. We didn't know as much about it as we wanted to. None of us have, in our careers have really specialized on early 19th century Corps of Engineer history. This was a chance to do that. What we discovered was that the politics of the General Survey Act were divided by region, which is not perhaps surprising. Generally, coastal states opposed federal funding for internal improvements, which would ultimately generate competition for East Coast ports like New York City, Boston, Charleston. You had the new influence of Western states that were just getting populated. Farm products were just being produced in surplus by 1820. And their legislators understood the importance of creating a river and shaping a river that could facilitate transfer of those goods downriver. Also, you had galvanizing power of Western political leaders like Henry Clay and Andrew Jackson. Jackson would ultimately be a two-term U.S. president, a very influential one. Henry Clay was at the time of the passage of the General Survey Act, the Speaker of the House. And of course, he was from Kentucky, Jackson from Tennessee, two really important figures in that era of American history. There's also an interesting contrast between New York and Pennsylvania. As I said, Eastern Seaboard states tended to oppose the legislation for federal funding of internal improvements, partly out of just sheer selfishness. They needed traffic in their ports to flourish, and they didn't want to be paying to fund their competition from New Orleans and around. And New York fell into that mold very well. And of course, at that point, New York was the nation's largest state by population. New York City was already, thanks to the Erie Canal, becoming the dominant economic center of the country. And Pennsylvania had Philadelphia on the East Coast, and it was struggling to compete with New York, but it didn't have an Erie Canal bringing goods from the Great Lakes regions to its directly to its ports, and it needed to find ways to compete. Pennsylvania is a long state. Of course, you have Philadelphia on one side and Pittsburgh on the other, and you have a mountain range in the middle. And so internal improvements were going to be key to making Pennsylvania competitive with New York. And so Pennsylvania, in the end, plays the pivotal role in deciding to support the General Survey Act and getting it pushed through. So you have regional divisions. You also have party divisions, and that's one of the interesting stories to follow out of this as well. We saw in 1824, in that year, political splintering almost unequaled at any time in U.S. history. So until 1824, if you studied survey history, you took history in college, you probably remember the term era of good feelings. That was the period from 1800 to 1824 when the Democratic-Republican Party, it was a single party, not the Democrats, not the Republicans, but the Democratic-Republican Party utterly dominated national politics. The Whig Party disappeared after 1816, or rather, excuse me, the Federalist Party disappeared after 1816 and was no longer a major player. And so the Democratic Republicans effectively did what they wanted, and they did so under what we refer to now and even contemporarily as the Virginia Dynasty. That would be Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe. So three Virginia presidents in a row, each serving two terms for a period of 24 years. That all began to collapse by 1824, and in that year, you had three major factions, but really more. The three major factions were the Jackson Republicans, who had a Western bent and pretty strongly favored internal improvements. You had the Crawford Republicans. These were the William Crawford of Georgia Republicans, and Crawford was sort of the heir apparent for Monroe, who was finishing his second term, hand-selected by the Virginia Dynasty, but unfortunately had health issues and did not ultimately win the national support he would need to become president. The Crawford Republicans upheld that Virginia dynasty and its longtime opposition to internal improvements, or certainly federal funding for internal improvements. And then you had a John Quincy Adams slash Henry Clay faction, which was largely split on the issue and split based on location. So John Quincy wing of mainly Federalists was generally in opposition, and the Henry Clay faction out of Kentucky was unanimously in support of internal improvements. So you had the politics was divided by region and by party, and the chips fell as they may, and the bill was passed finally in April 1824.
That's interesting hearing about the history there, and in particular, it sounds like the conflict potentially between the states and maybe even the federal government. Did this create any constitutional challenges, or were there any constitutional questions that needed to be resolved as part of this process?
It's a great question. This legislative history of the General Survey Act that we just completed has taught us a few things. The conventional wisdom on these constitutional issues basically went this way, that Congress recognized the need for road improvements and river improvements, but there were long-established concerns about the constitutionality of federal legislation on internal improvements. Could the federal government fund internal improvements that would benefit one state, sometimes at the expense of another? Generally, the idea among strict constructionist Southerners was that such funding was not constitutional. Of course, Southerners were also concerned about keeping the federal government in its lane because they were concerned about issues of slavery. It was also commonly held belief among the several Virginia presidents who constituted the Virginia dynasty I just mentioned, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe. All three were generally opposed to federal spending on internal improvements. Not in theory, they actually favored spending the federal dollars on internal improvements and understood the long-term benefits to the nation, but they couldn't see clear defining a constitutional justification for it. And so that's all part of the traditional understanding, the conventional wisdom of the constitutional issues, that there were power centers who favored internal improvements, but that they couldn't get past the constitutional, their own constitutional scruples over the issue. Our recently completed legislative history does clarify to some extent that constitutional issues about federal funding for internal improvements did not get entirely in the way of immediate political motivations in the House of Representatives, which passed a third reading, which is a procedural motion that generally serves as a precursor to passage, in the weeks before the Supreme Court took up the issue of internal improvements in its famed Gibbons versus Ogden case. So traditionally, we thought there was opposition based on constitutional scruples. The Supreme Court solved those constitutional scruples and the legislation was passed. We now know that it was a little more complicated than that, and that majority in the House of Representatives was perfectly willing to pass the General Survey Act without constitutional input from the Supreme Court. That's new.
Very interesting. So the first Rivers and Harbors Act for improvements on the Mississippi and Ohio rivers followed the General Survey Act. What did the first Rivers and Harbors Act actually do?
So it's a great point, Angela, that there are two pieces of legislation here, both passed 1824 and both of them celebrating 200th anniversary in the last month or so. Both important. One way to think of it is that the General Survey Act authorized the use of Army engineers in river improvement and road construction, and that the first Rivers and Harbors Act authorized funding for actual projects. The two were important together. Ultimately, a lot of money would get spent on both pieces of legislation over time, subsequently. But again, the General Survey Act was mainly about authorizing a very talented group of Army engineers, including, at this point, topographical engineers and the Corps of Engineers, to conduct internal improvements outside the Army. And then the Rivers and Harbors Act authorized specific funding for specific projects.
I think that's interesting how this all works. I'm kind of, you know, wanted to go back a little bit. I'm really interested in the constitutional challenges and questions that we had talked about earlier. And maybe it's just because, currently I feel like you hear about the Supreme Court fair amount in the news. And obviously the Supreme Court is one of the three branches of government with that checks and balances. And how you'd mentioned that the House passed a bill without, you know, consulting with the Supreme Court. And in preparation for this podcast, I'd run across a case, Gibbons versus Ogden, I believe. And I was wondering, really, how did that Supreme Court ruling really play in the passage of both this General Survey Act and this First Rivers and Harbors Act?
It's such a good question. And I should clarify that the House passed the General Survey Act, at least through a third reading, without seeing how the Supreme Court was going to weigh in on the issue. But almost certainly Monroe would have vetoed any legislation coming out of Congress, and probably the Senate wouldn't have passed the bill either. So Gibbons versus Ogden is still a very important ruling in understanding the passage of both the General Survey Act and the Rivers and Harbors Act. So Gibbons versus Ogden clarified the constitutional position and authorized funding for internal improvements based on the Commerce Clause only. Not postal roads, not military justifications, strictly the Commerce Clause. That's important because during the debate in the House, you heard advocates arguing multiple different constitutional justifications for funding internal improvements. In the end, Gibbons versus Ogden weighed in only on the Commerce Clause and exclusively Commerce Clause, which meant that Congress could spend money to improve transportation in support of national commerce. A little bit on the court case itself, since it's such a vital one. At issue was a New York law dating to 1798, granting Robert Fulton and Robert Livingston, these are two titans in the development of the steamboat, a state monopoly on, quote, navigating all boats that might be propelled by steam on all waters within the territory or jurisdiction of the state of New York for a term of 20 years, end quote. The two men subsequently sold the operating license to Aaron Ogden and then passed away. And Ogden, who was a former New Jersey governor, proceeded to run a steamboat between Elizabethtown, which is in New Jersey, of course, and New York City. And he did so happily and very profitably for a while. Then in 1818, he was joined in this route by a man named Thomas Gibbons, who'd been licensed separately by the U.S. Congress under a 1793 law regulating coastal trade. So Ogden wants to protect his very lucrative trade route here. He files a complaint with the court chancellery in New York and won an injunction to stymie any competition from Gibbons. The latter went and got legal counsel, and not just any legal counsel. He got Daniel Webster, Webster, Clay, and Calhoun, the great triumvirate. Webster was probably the finest lawyer of that era. He had been the winning attorney in the McCullough versus Maryland case and was increasingly prominent congressman from Massachusetts, then serving on the House Judiciary Committee. The case was litigated all the way to the Supreme Court, as we know, where Chief Justice John Marshall. So a lot of big names here in early American history. Marshall ruled ultimately in favor of Gibbons, carrying out the clear intent of the Constitution to have Congress, rather than individual states, regulate interstate commerce, but also intrastate commerce that impacted interstate commerce. So the landmark ruling empowered the federal government, through the Commerce Clause only again, to conduct internal improvements of a national character. And of course, shortly after, advocates for legislation pending in Congress took the win and moved quickly to successfully pass the General Survey Act in late April, and then subsequently a First Rivers and Harbors Act in the following month.
Thanks, Matt. That's really interesting history. It's interesting to hear about the origins of the Corps of Engineers Civil Works Program from 1802 to 1824. And unfortunately, we're out of time for this episode, but we're going to hear more about our episode focusing on 1824 to 1865 in a couple of weeks. I do want to thank you, Matt, John, and Jonah, for joining us today for this edition of Inside the Castle. We appreciate you and your insights. Until next time, be safe, be innovative, and remember your history.
Thanks for joining us for this Inside the Castle podcast. To provide your feedback, email us at cw.infrastructure.team@usace.army.mil. Stay tuned for additional Inside the Castle podcasts as we explore life inside the Corps and revolutionize civil works together.